The conference is now being recorded.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Construction Law Committee meeting of the Florida Bar's Real Property Probate and Construction Law Section for November 10, 2014. Today is the first meeting that we have decided we will record and put out as a podcast so that we can let others who couldn't attend the meeting catch it, as well as our CLE presentation. As is our tradition, we'll start with opening remarks and introduction to officers. I'm Hardy Roberts, the current chair of the committee. Scott Pence is our vice chair, as is Lee Weintraub, and our secretary is Robert Doan. There's a couple new things, I guess. We've got some new subcommittees on our committee today that we've got on the agenda. We've also got a new format for the agenda. You can email me with whether you like it or not, but basically I just got bored with the old version. So our first order of business, Robert Doan circulated our meeting minutes from October. Has anyone had a chance to review those? We have a motion to approve them.
So moved.
Any second?
Okay. I'll second.
All right. So hearing nothing from anyone out there, our minutes for October are approved. With that, we'll move on into our subcommittee, some of which may not have reports because they're new and recently formed, but we'll start with our ABA forum liaison, Carrie Wright. And before I turn it over to you, just a reminder for some who clicked in, we are recording the call today and planning to put it out as a podcast. So, Carrie, off to you.
Okay, thanks, Hardy. We just had the ABA fall meeting in Chicago a couple of weeks ago. It was very well attended, 499 people attended, which I think is a record for the fall. And again, it was Steve Lesser's first meeting as chair. Our next meeting is going to be the end of January in Scottsdale, January 29th through the 30th. And the title is My Favorite Mistakes, What Doesn't Bankrupt You Makes You Stronger. It's going to be another, you know, very good meeting. If you're able to go, and I encourage you to go, register now. Get your hotel room because that is Super Bowl weekend. So rooms are going to be hard to get once the block rooms are taken up. The regional programs, which are held simultaneously at five or six locations around the country, that's going to be February the 27th. And this year we will have a regional program in Florida, and it's going to be in Fort Lauderdale. And it may be in the Becker and Polikoff's office, but I'm not a certain about that.
That's where it is.
It is? Okay, good. Yeah. If you have younger lawyers, and I think it's the Sticks and Bricks this year, it's a great program, always gets real high marks. And that's a good program for the younger lawyers or really any level to go to. And then the annual meeting this year, again, Steve's year, is going to be in Boca Raton, and that's going to be in April the 16th through the 18th at the Boca Raton Resort and Club. And, again, that's going to be one that will have a real strong presence of Florida lawyers. We're going to do what we've done with the ABA in the past. We promote, you know, to the Florida Bar, and then we'll have a joint reception on Thursday night where, you know, it's the Florida Bar with the ABA sponsored, and there's no cost to the Florida Bar other than our cooperation with what we're doing. And we're also trying to reach out to law students, and I've reached out to the people on this committee, and if someone that I haven't spoken to, if you're teaching a law school class or you have any connections with the law schools, let me know. As soon as the brochure comes out, we're going to promote that amongst the law students, try to get good participation from them as well. And then the fall meeting next year will be in Austin, Texas, October 8th and the 9th. And then the following midwinter meeting is going to be in San Francisco, and that's 2016, January 21 through 22. And then the annual meeting after that will be in Nashville. There's a lot of stuff going on with the forum. If you want to get involved, please just send me an email. And there's a lot of Florida lawyers involved at the different divisions and steering committees, and with Steve being chair, we can really integrate you into any of the divisions that you want to be integrated into. And also, one final thing, the forum has an app. So if you want to go to the Google Store or the Apple Store and type in Forum on Construction Industry or FCA, it's Forum on Construction Law, actually, you can download an app for free, and it will have all your scheduling, your events, and we will flip it into a meeting app as we get closer to the meetings where you have all of your speakers, the bios, the papers, everything at your on your mobile device. So, and that's my report.
Thanks, Kerry. We had a lot of
right
people
now.
Buzz in late, so just to remind you, something new for our committee, we're recording the call. And don't forget to click on the attendance link that you were emailed through the listserv to note your attendance today as well. We'll move on to our new ADR subcommittee that Deborah Mastin's chairing. Deb, are you with us today?
I think she's in an arbitration. I'd heard earlier.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, she is in an arbitration. So we've started or reformed, however you want to put it, an alternative dispute resolution subcommittee within our committee. If you are interested in participating in that and helping Deb out, send either her an email or me, and I'll forward it to her. Next up is the certification exam. Fred Dudley. Fred, are you here?
I am. I haven't checked the most recent number of applications, but one of our new members, David Manassi, is here with us this morning, and he has applied. So there were
Welcome,
seven.
David.
If you haven't gotten a letter from David and his firm lately, when you do, call me right now. David is the prosecutor for the Board of Architecture and Interior Design. So some of you may have the pleasure of meeting him over the next months or years. Well, that's it for now. 17
right,
applications as of last count, but there was another week to go.
Fred, what do you typically have for applications? How many?
In the past 3 or 4 years, we've consistently ranged from 40 to 45, with about 37 to 38 taking the exam. We always have a handful who don't show, which means they can reapply the following year with a short application. And most of them do reapply and retake or take it a second year. That's it.
Thanks, Fred. Next up, the certification review course. Deb Mastin is not here. Clara Margaret Gruber, are you here?
Hey, Hardy. This is Brian Renzi. I'm actually the co-chair with Deb.
Oh, I don't know where I got that thing. Good grief. Thanks, Brian, for straightening me out. I'll fix it on the next agenda.
Yeah, I'm down a little bit, Hardy.
Got it. Okay, thanks.
Right now,
we have our
speakers locked in. They are ready to go. We are running a conflict check with the CLI just to make sure that there's no time conflicts. We should have that done by midweek, and we're planning to have our final speaker lineup sent to the Florida Bar by the end of the week.
Great, Brian, and sorry for the error on the agenda here.
That's okay.
Next up, the Construction Law Institute. Reese Henderson, are you here today?
Yes, Hardy, I'm here. And, I would be the one Brian's looking for to clear those conflicts. So, yes, Brian, I will be getting back to you this week. We have, of course, the Construction Law Institute and the Certification Review Course are being held in conjunction with each other. It'll be the 8th Annual Construction Law Institute this year. It's scheduled for March 12th through 14th, 2015, next year at the J.W. Marriott Orlando Grand Lakes. So it'll be a new location. It's a very beautiful location. It's a hotel that is adjoined to the Ritz. The golf tournament will be held again this year starting on the 12th, and this will be on the very highly rated, award-winning Marriott, J.W. Marriott golf course there. It's won numerous awards and is a very premier course. So those of you interested in golf, be sure and sign up for the tournament. And we have the usual excellent lineup of speakers. We're going to be covering things such as the ethical use of social media and litigation, effective discovery techniques in the electronic world, building code basics for construction attorneys, and many, many other topics. And by popular demand, we have arranged the schedule so that we will be finishing up the course at about 1:30 on Saturday afternoon. For those of you wanting to have your afternoon free on Saturday to spend with the family or what have you, we've got the course situated such that you'll be finished by 1:30. So encourage everybody to be looking. We should have the brochure finalized and published and available for folks to locate on the website probably around the first or second week of December. And so be looking for that, and we'll be, of course, circulating information. I imagine, Hardy, through the listserv as well, with your permission, once we have that the brochure finalized. So and also we'll be having an ad published in Action Line as well for folks looking for that information. So look forward to another great event. And anybody has any questions, feel free to contact me or anybody on the committee for further information. And that's my report.
Thanks, Reese, and we're happy to circulate whatever you need, or if there's some other way the committee at large can support your efforts, just let us know.
Very good.
Next up, a brand new subcommittee for the committee, construction litigation, led by Neil Sivier. Neil, are you there? You have any comments or anything you want to report?
I am here. I don't really have any comments since we were just formed. Based on the preference selections, there are only six folks in our committee so far. Please feel free to email me at nsivier, S-I-V-Y-E-R, at sbwlegal.com. Again, that's nsivier, S-I-V-Y-E-R, at sbwlegal.com. And I'll give everybody a couple of weeks, and as soon as I figure out who all is going to be in our committee, I'll set up an initial conference call. I would think this would be one of the most relevant committees, since we're talking about a variety of litigation issues, and I'm looking forward to it. So thanks, Hardy.
Thanks, Neil. And you mentioning only six members is an opportunity for me to interject a comment. The committee at large has over 600 members. You, with six pre-selected members of your subcommittee, has instantly made you our largest and most populated subcommittee, I think, because the Construction Law Institute and Review Course, these are actually separate committees of the section of the division that are reporting to us. So one of the things we really want to do is spread the work of the Construction Law Committee out amongst all the subcommittees, and not just have it be some subcommittee chairs doing stuff, but get folks working together and take an advantage, and we can dole out who reports in a given month and spread that out. So if you're not involved in a subcommittee and it's your area, get involved in it, because you can meet some folks and help and do some good stuff. And if you're chairing one of the subcommittees, bring some other folks in and spread the work out. So just a little plug there. Moving forward, construction regulation with Fred Dudley and Steve Sellers.
This is Steve. I have three cases for today. The first one came out last Friday from the 5th DCA. It's Transportation Engineering, Inc. versus Cruise. This was really a tragic case, but a young lady was killed when the car she was riding in on the turnpike impacted the unprotected end of a guardrail. And her estate sued DOT and the design engineer for not having a guardrail expressly designed, and the contractor for not installing one. On motions for summary judgment, the court granted summary judgment to the contractor under the Slavin Doctrine, saying that this was if it was a defect, it was a patent defect, and the DOT had accepted the project. The engineer tried to get the same argument and has a case that it relied on, Easterday versus Maziallo. It's a Florida Supreme Court case from 1988, but the trial court said no and did not grant summary judgment to them. So the appellate court, there was an interlocutory appeal. The appellate court ruled that no, we have the same circumstances of a defect in the design and acceptance by DOT, same causation, and the trial judge should have granted summary judgment to the engineer on that same basis. That same rule applies to architects as well. I didn't put this in the case report, but there's an interesting procedural issue, and that is that the engineer had to appeal this summary judgment in favor of the contractor. It had to appeal it itself. And that's because if they hope to have any argument at trial that if they're liable, there are others that should also be have liability apportioned to them, they had to take this appeal at that time. So the next case is a arbitration case, Spicer versus Tenet, and this is a fourth DCA case. I thought this was interesting because the trial judge had granted a motion to compel arbitration of an employment dispute, and the appellate court reversed and said there is no sufficient arbitration agreement because the procedures were not agreed on, the arbitration procedures. They had tried to incorporate by reference another document that did have the procedures, but the testimony was that the employee had not ever seen that document, and it had not been provided to her until about 3 weeks after she became an employee. The interesting thing is that the court said that if your contract incorporates Florida law, then that necessarily incorporates the procedures found in the Florida Arbitration Code. And therefore, if that had been the case, then that would be sufficient. But if you're writing an arbitration clause, you need to make sure you include the procedures or at least a reference to something that does have the procedures in it. Last case is a federal case from the Middle District of Florida, and this was just orders on motions, cross motions, I think, for summary judgment. This is the case where a condo association, initially they sued the contractor for defects relating to stucco and got a default judgment against the contractor. They then went after the contractor's general liability insurance company, and their issue was whether the company had sufficient notice or not. The trial judge said that just getting a 558 notice in this particular case, under this, the terms of this policy, provides notice of a claim but not notice of a suit, and therefore they did not meet the notice requirements under the terms of this policy. However, the court also said that there's still an issue about whether the insurance company was prejudiced or not, and it appeared from the language that she used in her decision that she was going to be pretty lenient about that. She was looking at whether the insurance company had a reason to believe it was their insured and that there were defects, and I'm not sure she was going to look a whole lot beyond that. She also had an interesting thing that she threw out at the end that said, if this really was a defensible case and they were prejudiced, then the insurance company had an obligation to seek to set aside the judgment against the contractor. So that doesn't bode well for the insurance company. That's all that I have, Fred.
Well, under the administrative actions, I call your attention to the bottom of page 2. The Charles Hunt deck statement that was issued by CILB, where they said that a contractor needs to complete the specialized continuing education course before submitting plans and specs, if required by the local building department, which requires a calculation of wind loads. Right now, contractors do not have to use the signed and sealed plans of a design professional for residential properties. Then there are several that will be taken up this Friday that begin on the middle of page 3. I don't know what a sports area, and that should be area instead of arena, area. I don't know what a sports arena dasher board is, but this is a petition seeking a determination as to licensing requirements for the installation of that type of of equipment, apparently for an ice rink. Broward County is asking in item X there, number 10, whether or not a mechanical or class A or B air conditioning contractor can install the air conditioning wiring is used to shut down the system controlled by a fire control panel. That's going to be an interesting one to hear, but I'm not sure Broward County Board of Rules and Appeals has any standing to be asking that. It also may impact on the fire code, which the CILB cannot interpret. The precast erectors case is also on the agenda for this Friday, and they're asking about the licensing requirements for precast and pre-stressed concrete panels and beams when they're working as a subcontractor under a contractor. And there is a provision that says that if you're doing work that doesn't require a class or a Division II license, then you can work under the direct supervision of a Division I licensee. So I suspect that one will be granted. And the last one there is a contractor of tennis courts requesting a determination of licensing requirements, apparently for the construction of tennis courts, although they never actually say that in their petition. Let me just point out to you on page 6, the Building Commission is now undertaking a lot of petitions for deck actions. The middle one there is interesting, the HFZ Capital Group, DBA, the Shore Club. That's our friend Robert Fine from the Greenberg firm out of Miami. He had obtained a favorable deck statement in 2007, and he's now asking if that same deck statement can now apply or be applied by his local building official where the facts are consistent. It's interesting because it points out that you can use a petition for deck statement to inquire about the application of another deck statement, because the rules on deck statements not only apply to determination of your rights, duties, and responsibilities under a statute or under a rule, but also under a final order of any board, and that's what deck statements come in the form of, or the deck statement itself. Lastly, I point out on that page a new feature where I'm going to be including the interpretations for building code, including this City of Cape Coral, which is presently pending. And the last thing I want to point out to you is on the last page, there are so many petitions for deck statement and waiver being filed with the Division of the Office of State Fire Marshal that I hesitate to list all of them. They're usually highly specialized, where a fire chief is asking a question about a particular fire code provision as to a particular project. But if any of you are interested in me continuing that, I'll do so at no additional charge. Finally, legislative action, there's been no change. There will be an organizational session a week from tomorrow, 2 weeks after the general election, the 18th of November, at which the incoming officers will be officially elected for both the House and the Senate. That is the Speaker and the Speaker pro tempore, and the same with the President and pro tempore in the Senate. But still, as of today, no bills have been filed in either chamber other than the Senate claims bill have a deadline of 1 August. I suspect that after we're going to be beginning next week, we're going to see a flood of new bills as legislators are back in town for the first time since they adjourned sine die back in May. So I'll keep you posted.
Excellent. Yep. Steve and Fred, thanks very much. Next up is Clara Margaret Gruber with our brand new construction transaction subcommittee. Clara Margaret, I don't know if you have anything to report or just comments or what. Go ahead.
Well, I thanks very much. I don't have anything to report, but obviously I want to invite anyone who's interested in this, doing this level of detail in our great construction claims world, This is a very exciting part of the practice where we get to make evidence and lose sleep worrying about what could possibly happen in the future. And so if you're faint-hearted, the faint-hearted need not apply. But we are a committee now of two. Scott Pence and I are handling this committee together, and everyone is welcome. If you've got ideas on practice tips, things like that, we would like to report monthly some practice tips out of the issues of the day. So we'll try to make this worthwhile and not mind-numbing for everybody.
Thanks very much. Next up, our two former chairs and committee stalwarts, Lee Weintraub and Kerry Wright, will talk about the contractors university concept that we're working on.
So this program was born out of a desire to add another element of membership in the construction law committee, and that is an opportunity to develop some work for us. So to do that, we asked ourselves how we can get some of our CLC members in front of contractors, subs, design professionals potentially in a potentially business-generating climate. So Contractors University is still in the process of being shaped. Our committee met as recently as this morning, and the goal is to launch it by early fall of 2015. But the basic premise of it is a series of workshops that will be held in sponsor law firms around the state, approximately 10 every year to 2 years, rotating around the state. And the premise is, rather than just being talking head substantive lectures like most seminars are, it's going to be very interactive, practical, business significant type workshops, ideally with small groups of contractors at a time, maybe about 10 to 20 contractors in a room, and a small number of speakers for each particular workshop, half-day workshop. Not so much talking about the law, but talking about business practicalities of construction. For instance, we take a topic, let's say contract administration, and just talk about what may happen in contract administration, what are the business policies that the attendees have been using, what are wise business policies, not just from what the law suggests, but also what business practices suggest. Just to get, you know, a free flow of information and some creative mental juices more on the business counseling side than on the legal counseling side. Also with the idea of creating some written work product for the contractors to take back that aren't just seminar outlines, but usable checklist for lean perfection or page of contact information and details for different ADR opportunities or things like that. So very practical, something that's going to set us apart from typical seminars that these contractors attend. We're looking to probably partner with various trade associations around the state for their membership and co-sponsor with them. So this is in the process of developing. We have identified today the locales around the state that this thing will rotate among, and they're really the usual suspects. It's going to be Miami, Southwest Florida, Orlando, a West Palm, Broward County location, Tampa, Jacksonville, somewhere in the Panhandle, then somewhere in Atlanta, or not somewhere, but probably Carlton Fields' office in Atlanta, to reach out to the Atlanta contractors who Florida pretty regularly. Our next meeting, which is set for a couple weeks out, we're going to develop the programming concept a little bit better. Sponsorship.
Hey, Lee, hold on 1 second. Let me interrupt. If you're ruffling a bag of chips into your speakerphone, please put us on mute, not hold. Thanks.
Thanks, Hardy. And after we get a little bit more definition to the programming concept, we're going to turn our attention to how we're going to handle the law firm sponsor opportunities and speaker opportunities and how we can make it as available as possible to as many of you as possible, understanding that we are, I think, the largest reptile section, certainly the second largest, if not the largest. So it's kind of hard to throw it out for everybody, but we want to make it as available as possible. But that is the update of where we are right now in getting this thing developed. Kerry, is there anything you wanted to add?
No,
No, I think that's it. If you want to get involved, I'd encourage you to shoot Lee an email because we're going to be looking for speakers and, you know, sponsoring firms.
But don't send me an email yet if you're interested in speaking or sponsoring. That's premature. Carrie's right. We need to know that if you're interested, but just not yet. If you do want to join the committee, though, and come up with ideas and work on planning, definitely send Carrie and I emails.
Yeah.
Thanks, y'all. Next up, Legislative Subcommittee. Scott, what's going on?
Thanks, Artie. I just wanted, before I get into my report, I want to just mention that we do have 14 members on our subcommittee. So I'm sure that this will change soon, but right now I take that as we're the largest subcommittee within the committee. But as you know, we've been very busy, and I reported last month on two issues that are still ongoing, one of which is the priority of lien statute in 71307, and the problem study committee had proposed some changes to that statute, basically to address a situation where there might be new financing involved in a project or a transfer of ownership, and rather than the current statute requiring a contractor to stop performance and start back up, the proposed changes were really intended to kind of make it so that stop-start issue wasn't really necessary. So we're continuing to work back and forth on that. I think we're nearing an end on that. So I'm hoping that by next month's call, that will be resolved one way or the other. And then the other issue was Representative Corcoran from Pasco County had been throwing around some ideas or concepts of potentially filing a bill where the lien law would be excluded for residential projects where the home was homesteaded, as it relates to lienors who were not in privity with the owner. So we met with a few of us from the subcommittee, met with Representative Corcoran to try to talk through the issues and kind of get a better feel for why he felt that these changes were necessary, maybe to offer some alternatives, because I think we're kind of the opinion. And I think after meeting with him, I'm even more so of this opinion. And, you know, Lee, feel free to chime in if you feel otherwise. But I think I left that meeting feeling that this is not a question of if, but it's going to, you know, something is going to be filed. And so we can either try to participate now and get something that we might be able to live with or kind of sit back on the sidelines and, react to it once it has been filed. So one of the things that came out of that meeting was a discussion. We had a discussion of, under the current statute, if there's financing, if there's a lender involved, and the lender makes payments directly to the contractor, the lender assumes responsibility for obtaining the lien releases and things like that. One of the things we talked about was, I guess there's a current trend anecdotally that lenders get around that by making those payments directly to the contractor and instead make the payments to the owner so they don't have to assume that responsibility. So one of the kind of the spitballing ideas that Representative Corcoran, I think, really liked was potentially revising the statute to make it so that if there was financing on a project, that the lender then would be responsible for complying with the lien law on these residential homesteaded projects. So we're currently going to be putting something together to that effect and sending it over to the representative for him to review. I suspect that what's going to happen, because you know I'm sure that there's going to be a big backlash from the lending community in that regard. So I suspect what's going to happen is we're going to send it over, and we may have to, as a committee or you know as part of the section, have to retreat. One other thing that came out of that meeting was that the representative was proposing that the residential exclusion, which I think is now at $2,500, be raised to somewhere around $50,000. And that's something that we immediately had told the representative that from the Construction Law Committee's perspective, we didn't think that we would be able to get behind that and support that. So that change will not be reflected in the language that we send back over, but again, I suspect that once he gets it, that will be, you know, that will be included in those revisions, and we may, as a committee, have to retreat or actually oppose that portion of it. But stay tuned, because, you know, there certainly will be more, and we'll keep you posted as it happens. But that's my report.
Scott, thanks a lot for that. Next up, our membership subcommittee, Arnie.
Hi, Mr. Chair. How are you?
I am well. How about you, Mr. Former Chair?
I am doing great. We only have one new member, which Fred mentioned earlier, David Manassi, for the month of October, bringing us to a total of 611 members, Mr. Chair.
And now, David, what took you so long?
It just took me hanging out with Fred for a little bit to enlighten me.
Yeah, that and the fact that for years he didn't want anything to do with us construction lawyers. Now he likes us.
You had to shake off the hangover from too many years at Beeper.
That was probably part of it as well.
Hardy, you were general counsel when David was over there.
This is true. It's true. Now you've outed me, Fred. You notice I didn't claim that. All right.
You were one of the better ones we had.
Well, nice of you to say. Next up, our publication subcommittee, Sean Mickley. He couldn't be here, but he sent me a very detailed email, which I will share with you all if I can pull it up. All right, it crashed. But the gist of it is he just published an article in Action Line and wanted to thank Lee for Weintraub for helping get that through. So thanks to Lee for that. It's going to be in the fall issue. Also, there's another article in the pipeline for publication in the winter edition of Action Line. And Sean is soliciting articles for the spring 2015 version of Action Line. So if you have an article submission, please email Sean Mickley, or you can email me, and I will forward it along to him. Next up on our agenda is small business programs, but Lisa couldn't be here today, so no report there, and no report from our surety and insurance subcommittee either. The tech subcommittee, I've appointed myself as head of the tech subcommittee, and its current project is recording this call and doing a podcast, and Brent's volunteered to switch over and take care of the website subcommittee, where we could probably use some help. And the next technological leap for our committee here is going to be to start running things through the website, which will give us a single place where you can get materials, get the link for attendance, pull up the agenda, do all of this. It'll be great because it's one container in one place, and you can look at things backwards and see if you were there at the meeting and all that. The only negative is you're going to have to make your peace with a username and password and how to save that in your browser, which will help everybody figure out how to do that and get through getting your credentials at the Reptiles website. So that rounds out our committee reports. Any comments, suggestions, or new business anyone wants to volunteer? All right, we'll keep moving forward then. Next up, Angela Covington is chairing our CLE subcommittee, and the agenda lists some of the upcoming programs there. But, Angela, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Hardy. If anyone has any ideas or topics they'd like to hear in the coming months, I think we're set through March, but I'm always happy to have any ideas. Today, we're fortunate to have George Meyer speak on integrated project delivery. George Meyer is a construction and real estate lawyer with Carlton Fields. He has extensive experience representing owners, developers, contractors, and designers on large, complex development projects. He handles all types of construction and real estate transactions, including the preparation, negotiation, closing, and administration of development agreements, construction contracts, design-build contracts, construction management agreements, purchase and sale contracts, option agreements, easements, leases, operating agreements, and project financing facilities. George has worked on major projects all across the country, including many stadiums, arenas, ballparks, convention centers, airports, pipelines, refineries, and railroads, just to name a few. George is a board-certified attorney in construction law by the Florida Bar. and is a fellow of the American College of Real Estate Lawyers and the American College of Construction Lawyers. He served as the chair of the ABA's Forum on the Construction Industry and as the chair of the Reptile Section of the Florida Bar. In 2012, George received this committee's Lifetime Achievement Award, so we are very lucky to have him speak today. George, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Angela. Before I give it to George, everyone, I'm going to mute everyone on the line, and then once George is done talking, I'll unmute folks.
The conference is now in silent mode.
All right. Thank you, Angela. And it's interesting, Claire Margaret, to show how important your subcommittee is. I think the fact that it was decided that the first of these CLEs to record should be a construction transaction topic, I think, is very appropriate to show the importance of your subcommittee. I was asked to speak about integrated project delivery. It's sometimes referred to as collaborative contracts. It's a term of art that is, I have found, to be very loosely used. A lot of contracts are being called IPD or collaborative when they're really not. A true IPD is something that is completely different. It is a completely different project delivery method. You all out there are very familiar with the different forms of project delivery, you know, design, bid, build, design, build, CM at risk, all these various project delivery methods. And this IPD is another new project delivery. It's not just a design build or CM at risk, you know, that has been beefed up a little bit. I will say I've looked at and viewed probably over a dozen of these contracts, and up until about a year ago, none of them was really a true IPD. Most of them were just a CM at risk or a design build where, you know, someone would throw in some terms that required collaboration among the parties, but at the heart and the essence, it was still just a design build or a CM at risk. So I would caution against, you know, the fact that merely they're calling it an IPD doesn't necessarily make it so. About a year ago, I finally ran across one that truly is an IPD project, and what I found more surprising was it was a Disney project. But it really took the leap of faith and went into the IPD. Now, a little bit of a historical background on IPDs. They tended, they first were used as alliance contracts. They were called alliance contracts up in the North Sea platform projects and then over in Australia and New Zealand with some infrastructure projects. They were designed for highly complex, highly schedule challenged, high risk projects. And this was a way, the scene of trying to address that. In the States, we're seeing it, you know, on some hospital projects, it's being proposed on hospital projects. Seeing it on some P3 type of projects where you're dealing with infrastructure and there's a need for more of a collaborative approach. Part of what's driving this IPD, and by the way, it is very limited in use. The vast majority of the contracts out there are still, you know, the traditional ones we've all grown up with and love to use and litigate over. But part of the reason that pushed for the IPD was the fact that, you know, if you look at the various major industries out there, the construction industry has probably one of the lowest productivity growths of any industry. We're pretty flat. When you look at various studies that, you know, automotive, electronics, you know, these other major industries who for the past 50 years have gone through tremendous productivity gains, construction industry has stayed fairly flat and level. And this was viewed, this IPD approach was viewed as a way of maybe breaking through the traditional, you know, design, bid, build or design, build approach, which takes more of a silo approach to risk and liability in the contracts. Again, a little historical context. You know, back before the mid-1800s, you know, construction was really done by master builders, and oftentimes those master builders were engineers, because engineering was really, at that time, the only recognized profession. There was no such thing as architecture or architectural schools. I mean, it was mainly engineers and then, you know, people who had experience building or architects. But the master builder concept, then towards the late 1800s, we started seeing this approach of specialization, the architect, the engineer just being responsible for design, the contractor just being responsible for construction, and these silos of responsibility being created, whereby you know, an owner who starts project risk wants to hire an architect to, and they're only going to be responsible for the design and maybe some CA services, and they'll hire a contractor. But the concept being everybody staying in their silos. IPD takes less of an assignment of risk and responsibility, namely looking to create silos, and more of a sharing of the risk and responsibility, a collaborative approach to accomplishing the project. And if you want something to visualize it, think in terms of some of these in-house new product teams. An example I would give is somebody like Apple, who's going to want to come out with a new product. You know, they don't wind up, you know, just creating silos and say, you know, designers go design, and then after you're done designing, then we'll bring in production. After production, you do what you're doing, then we're going to bring in marketing. They bring all those people together in a single room, finance, design, marketing, production, and from day one, they're working together on that new product that they hope to come out with. And a concept here is they sink or swim together. You know, either we all, you know, the project is a success and therefore we are all successful, or it isn't and we're all taking a hit. And that is a concept that is keen within the IPD. And because of that sort of sink or swim together, a true hallmark of an IPD contract is trust. It's going to be more like a partnership or co-employee arrangement than independent contractors. Because you're dealing with collective day-to-day decision-making by the team, and by the team, we're talking about the owner, the designer, the contractor at a minimum. But oftentimes there will be certain key subcontractors who are brought onto the team. And it's that team approach, and your contract will define who the team is. And the challenge for your IPD contract is to figure out how do you incentivize people to put the project interests before their own? How do you motivate people to get out of their silos, especially when they've got lawyers like us who for years have been telling them, stay within your silo, don't volunteer. You start volunteering outside of your silo of responsibility, all you're doing is inviting more risk and liability on yourself. The whole approach of the IPD is get rid of the silos. Now, when working on an IPD contract, I think there are five key elements in that contract that will need to be addressed and need to, you know, there from day one. And the first one is early involvement of all the team players. And again, that's a capital T team. Those are your core people who are all going to be on this IPD team. And as I said earlier, it's going to be at least the owner, the designer, and the contractor, also some of the key subs. But what you're looking for, too, is early buy-in by everybody from day one, and then everyone involved in the decision-making since from day one as well. So that early involvement is crucial. Another element that is critical is reduced liability exposure for all team members. You know, we were talking earlier about how do you incentivize people to think in terms of the project and not their individual liability exposure. Well, a key element in that is you got to remove the liability exposure. So a hallmark of an IPD contract, and probably one of the biggest reasons why, you know, it seems like most owners aren't willing to really to make that final leap and go there, is that you create mutual waivers of liability among all the team players. And that includes the owner waiving liability back against the designer and the contractor and the key subs that are brought on. Everybody is waiving liability against each other. The only exclusions typically that I've seen are for gross negligence and willful misconduct. Those will be held out, and nobody's waiving as to that. But otherwise, you've got this waiver of liability and exposure out there. There's a shared risk reward basis for project outcome. And what do I mean by that? What typically the way these contracts are set up is that the contractor, the designer, the team, the subs who are part of the team, they get paid their costs. They're going to get paid their costs by the owner, no matter, quite frankly, what happens, the only exclusions being gross negligence or willful misconduct. Other than that, they're going to get paid their costs. The question is, do they get paid profit? And that's going to get tied to the jointly developed project goals. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a second, but keep in mind what we're talking about with the shared is the fact that if a particular subcontractor, let's say, screws up on the project and that results in certain costs being, extra costs being incurred, which winds up eating into the project goal for the budget. Well, it's not just that sub's profit that gets eroded, you know, to make up for the hit against the budget. It's everybody's profit. So now what you've got is really an incentive to the team that you want everybody to succeed. You want, you know, because you know that, you know, it's no longer a case of, well, as long as it's not my fault, as long as I can keep my head buried in the sand, you know, I'm going to get my full profit and I'll be fine. No, everybody's taking a hit. And so, again, that whole sink or swim together approach. Obviously, if you're taking that shared risk, you're looking at joint project controls. Your contract will be written such that you're dealing with everybody involved in the decision-making process from day one. Very similar to what you all have probably seen in joint venture agreements, whereby, you know, the joint venture members or partners will all have a say. There's usually a management committee that's created. Now, there can be a difference in weighting of who's got how much vote to them, but it's still a group approach to decision making. It's intended to be a consensus building process, and so your contract has to reflect that. And then lastly, the fifth key element is something we touched on a little bit already, which is the jointly developed and validated project goals. Those goals must be challenging, but they got to be realistic, and so that's why it's the group that sets it. Now, typically, there'll be a goal for budget, you know, there'll be a goal for schedule, and then I've seen where there have also been goals for MWBE participation, safety, operating expenses and costs, you know, the fact that they're striving to have a more efficient project, maybe LEED certification. These goals are established out there and what is intended to be achieved. The idea being is that for the team members to make 100% of their profit, 100% of those goals need to be achieved. There's also oftentimes incentive or bonuses put in if you exceed the goals to encourage you to strive beyond and participate in, you know, additional bonuses that way. But as I said, they've got to be realistic. Visualize, if you will, you know, a salesman who is given an annual sales goal. You know, he wants to make the maximum on his commissions. He's got to meet his goal. If he comes in under the goal, oftentimes his commissions will be knocked down percentage-wise. So again, the contractors, the designers, the team, the subs who are members of the team get paid 100% of their costs. So they have no risk there. What they put at risk is their profit. Now, there's a couple of different IPD form contracts already out there. You have AIA, consensus documents, both have forms. In fact, the AIA has three different forms. There's one which they sort of call a modified traditional approach, where the architect signs one agreement, the contractor signs another agreement, and they share a common set of general conditions, sort of a halfway step to a true IPD. They have another form out there, which is a true single contract IPD contract form that incorporates these five elements I've just gone over. And then they have a third kind, which is essentially an LLC form, whereby the members who are going to be on the team jointly form a new LLC or some other type of SPE entity to take on the project and do it. I've also seen a couple of manuscript type of forms out there from that have been generated by a couple of different hospital groups and university groups as well. The first, decision that's got to be made is, you know, whether or not to use IPD on your project. Like any other project delivery, it better suits certain projects than other types of projects. I touched on it a little bit already from the historical context, which is, you know, IPD works well with high-risk, complex, fast-track, high-tech projects that are looking to be innovative. If this is some type of possibly a processing manufacturing plant that is looking for state-of-the-art innovations in its design and construction, IPD probably is a very good approach to use. I've seen it, you know, it seems like it's used a lot in P3 projects whereby you have the consortium that is being put together to pursue the project, and as it relates to the design and construction, you know, they'll enter into an IPD contract among the team players who are part of that consortium. IPD probably, quite frankly, I don't think it's a good selection for a public contract. Not only do you have obviously issues concerning about whether there's sufficient statutory authority to allow that form of contracting, but you know, getting the buy-in that you need to this sort of no-fault approach by the owner, I think it's highly complex when you're dealing with a public owner. Public owners are notorious for being risk avoiders. The politicians don't want risk. You know, the concept of having to explain to somebody in the press why they're still paying the contractor 100% of his costs, even though, you know, he made some screw up, and why we didn't hold him accountable, you know, doesn't work well for a 3-second sound bite on what were the advantages that they were trying to gain through the IPD approach. So I think public contracts will be a hard sell, at least for a while, until more experience is out there. The next key on putting together an IPD contract is selecting the team. And that starts with the owner, too. I mean, not all owners are really suited for this approach, because, again, you got to take that leap of faith and trust and be willing to waive liability against the designers and the contractors and the subs to make this work. in many ways, it's going to be like selecting, you know, partners for you, you know, in your law firm. I mean, how do you go about doing that? It's got to be somebody you completely trust and respect and feel like, you know, that they've got your back, you've got their back. I think it's probably best if there's been some prior successful project history among the team members. It'd be great if all the team members have worked together on a previous project and really know each other, but at least there's got to be some common threads. You know, the designer has worked with the owner, and that designer has worked with the contractor. There's got to be something to build that trust on. Because not all potential team members get it. Not all of them are really capable of breaking their historical competitive view of me against everybody else on this project. And you got to have somebody who's willing to do that, because if not, you're going to run into problems. They've got to, you know, sometimes said, they've got to play well in the sandbox with others. And this is very much a case where one bad apple in that mix on the team can just bring the IPD, you know, process to almost a screeching halt by the problems that would be created by that one bad apple. And that sort of takes us to one of the dark sides of IPD, and that is what happens if you have a bad apple as one of your team members. If you've got the owner who's the bad apple, you got some really big problems then. And you better hope that mutual waiver of liability is really strong and really clear, because you're going to be facing some very stiff problems. But if it's not, if it's one of the other team members, you know, how do you go about fixing that? And the agreements I've seen treat it almost like a no-fault divorce, if you will. What you've got is you got to have the ability, you know, based upon, again, a decision of the team, but ultimately a decision by the owner, quite frankly, that team member has to go. Unless we're talking about gross negligence or willful misconduct on their part, it's going to be a termination for convenience. Your documents will want to make it clear, you know, that they're not getting any profit. You're essentially going to pay them for what they've done to date, and you're going to jettison them. And then you got the follow-up question as to how you're going to replace that member. Is it a subcontractor who maybe the best way is just a traditional subcontractor approach, or is it the designer or the contractor, and you know, how you're going to bring in a new team member to fill that slot? Very complex issues. Hopefully something that you never really have to address. Hopefully you've made the team selection in a smart, intelligent way so that you've got people who are working together and have got it as far as the approach of IPD. Now, what are some of the benefits of the IPD? Well, we've been hearing, you know, it so far as I've been talking about that. You know, it's a very much of a collaborative approach, excellent for BIM projects and other projects involving high advanced technology. You're dealing with joint workshops, everybody involved in team decision making and consensus building from day one. Very much what you see on BIM. And for those of you who, you know, haven't used or seen BIM used too much, my own projection is that in about 10 years from now, it will be on the vast majority of the projects out there. Well, the benefits of what BIM can bring, not just to the design and construction process, but quite frankly to the whole operation of the facility afterwards, is just tremendous. Obviously, you're getting clash identifications, you know, during design, while also helping you, you know, the design team, and everybody on functionality of the design. An example there that I give is Disney, who has bought very heavily into BIM, as I understand it, has a room, that a virtual room that is set up so that as the design is moving forward, they can pretty much take any room they want and have it so that the people who will be using that room can put on a set of glasses, walk into the room, and be in a virtual room as fully mocked up in the design. And the example I was given was how they started doing that with their kitchens, their commercial kitchens. They'd have a design for how the kitchen was going to be laid out and where things are at. They'd bring in their chefs who would be operating in the kitchen, give them the glasses, put them in the room, and say, you know, walk around, see, you know, does this make sense? And right away, they'd start identifying problems and issues. They'd say, hold it, no, this station needs to be over here. This would be better if this was 2 inches lower over here. And they were making all these calls and making adjustments to design, you know, as the chefs were walking around through the virtual room. So the aspect of the design improvement that can be made, especially as it relates to functionality and operations, is huge. But you take it further. At the end of the project, not only at the end of the construction, not only are you turning over a set of excellent as-builts, but you're turning over an entire program that is designed to keep track of warranties, keep track of operating needs. It's tied into the building HVAC systems. It's all being part automated together. And so that's what's happening with BIM. BIM also, you know, as most of you know, you can layer in scheduling and cost. So as you're making design changes, it's automatically adjusting what the impact will be on these design changes on the schedule and the cost and the budget impacts of it. So, you know, BIM is just it's just the tip of the iceberg of what's being used currently, has tremendous productivity benefits to the industry. Another benefit of the IPD approach is innovation. I mean, again, having everybody in these workshops together from day one, throwing out ideas, suggestions on techniques and new building methods is very beneficial. It's often said from those who have gone through the IPD process that they feel that they have a higher quality and a better performing project. And again, it comes from the early involvement of all the players. Early identification of the goals, allowing for a more efficient and effective project planning, the better planning, making better use of the resources, and ultimately better functionality at lower cost, better budget controls, intelligently putting your resources where you'll get the biggest bang from it. All of that sort of flows from this heavy involvement from day one of the whole team in how this project is going to be designed and built. You also get much more timely and open communication among the team members. If there's some type of difficulty or even a problem that's identified, because of the shared risk and savings and the fact that everybody is sort of in this boat together and everybody's profit will take a hit if there's a problem, people are encouraged to try to identify and flag issues and problems as soon as possible so that they can be addressed as soon as possible so that they'll have a minimum impact on cost and schedule, and thereby hopefully, you know, mitigating or preventing any type of profit erosion because of the problem. So rather than being incentivized to, you know, seeing an issue or a problem and saying, well, I'm not going to say anything, maybe it won't get caught, maybe it won't get this, maybe it won't, and sort of putting your head in the sand, you're really incentivized to try to flag it as soon as possible. And another big aspect or benefit of the IPT contract format is, you know, fewer disputes. In fact, the goal is no disputes. The idea being is that these issues, any type of issues will be resolved early on. With the waiver of liability, you're not worried about somebody pointing the liability finger at you, and you know, so you spend a lot of time and effort trying to avoid that. You putting your energy into resolving the issue in a, as timely and as quickly manner as you can. Now, other issues to keep in mind when you're working with an IPD contract, obviously the first one is going to be, how do you handle that joint decision-making in the document? What's the process? The ones I've seen are basically a tiered approach where there'll be a sort of a day-to-day operating management level of people who are seeking to make the decision. If they can't reach a consensus among themselves, then there's a tiered approach, punching it up the stream to either, you know, the most senior level of management at each company, or you know, maybe an intermediate level of management, then followed by, you know, true upper senior management. Really depends how deep the management structure within the companies are. But this sort of tiered approach, ultimately, if a deadlock is there, it's the contracts I've seen, it's going to be the owner's decision. The owner's the one footing the bill here, paying all the costs. So ultimately, it will be an owner's decision. But those contracts also typically allow the parties to reserve their rights to appeal what that owner's final decision is, to have a independent party come in and look and see, you know, were they really in the wrong, or did they fail to meet that goal really, and were they entitled to some other type of adjustment? Another issue that you're going to have to be addressing is document ownership. Again, you know, a hallmark of the IPD is collaborative, joint input, especially if BIM is involved. When you're dealing with innovation and design, you're talking about derivative works when it comes to design. You're really going to need a strong and clear intellectual property provision in your contract that discusses what the joint rights of the parties are in the contract documents, whether it be cross-licensing or co-ownership, however it's going to be structured. I typically caution owners against sometimes their knee-jerk reaction to say, I want to own the documents. Well, you know, again, if I'm an owner and part of this whole design is some type of iconic look that's key to my marketing scheme for the next 10 years, yeah, I want to own the documents. I want that copyright. I need to make sure that that's locked down. But if I'm dealing with, some pretty standard, office or some industrial projects here, ownership isn't really all that essential. Now, having strong licenses that are irrevocable that allow me to do what I want to do out there without having to go back and getting and paying a fee to designers to get permission, that's of greater concern to me. Another aspect that's going to have to be addressed in the contract document is the relationship between the team members and the non-team members. As I said earlier, there's only if subcontractors are part of the team at all, it's typically just a few of the key subcontractors, maybe like HVAC the curtain wall or structural steel. Certain key ones will be brought in. Not all. In fact, most of the subs will be still subs just on a traditional approach. However, with an IPD contract, rather than the contractor being solely at risk for those traditional subs, it's really the team at risk for those traditional subs. So your contract's going to need to address that intersection between the IPD world and the silo world of those traditional subcontractors. Another aspect in your contract that you're really going to have to give careful consideration to is insurance and bonding. you know, it's going to be likely that you very well may have to educate your insurance agent or your brokers or your sureties about what is involved here. And you also, some products like OSIPs and CSIPs lend themselves nicely to the IPD world. Some of the other policies, maybe not so much so. Professional liability. If I've got a waiver of all liability, haven't I just waived, design errors and omissions? Well, yes, the waiver that you're giving is broad enough to cover that. So how do you address that? Do you do some type of carve-out on the waiver so that, you know, to the extent of insurance, so that at least it allows claims back to the insurance? Or there are some new insurance products that are out there now, rectification, mitigation, first-party coverage to the owner, whereby, you know, it's a policy that is, you know, to cover, you know, work that needs to be done because of a design error or construction defect. Expensive right now, but as IPT grows, potentially maybe it becomes more than more. Also, there's a question of whether or not do you really need to bond the contractor, again, given the waiver. So this, you really have to give careful consideration and a complete relook at how you're structuring insurance and bonding. Lastly, on other issues that you're going to have to give careful consideration is financing. If we're dealing with, you know, conventional construction loans and construction lenders, I question how many of them are going to really get it. I mean, they live in a world of guarantees, assignment of contract provisions, all the things that work well with a silo approach but do not work at all with an IPD approach. Same if you're, even if you're getting your project financing through bonds. You know, how do they go sell the bonds? How do they describe this contract now? It's not a traditional design, bid, build, or the traditional silo approach to contract. How do you develop the risk premiums? I think because of that financing issue, probably self-funded projects or P3 projects, again, are going to probably be more likely because you don't have to get into those issues and questions. Lastly, I just wanted to, you know, talk a little bit about what's the role of the lawyer in an IPD contract world. Well, you know, if you're representing your client on this, I would suggest that being an aggressive advocate, you know, is not going to be very helpful, quite frankly. What you're going to need to be is more of a counselor who helps people reach consensus. That, you know, that is what's in keeping with an IPD. You know, a party who can help those managers as they're meeting and they've got some, you know, sticky questions and to have to reach a consensus on, an attorney can help them and guide them in that process is going to be of much greater use to the team than, you know, than somebody who's just, you know, an advocate that, you know, whatever is in the best interest of their client, period, that's what's got to be thrown out there. So I think you need to be thinking about, you know, what your skill set is, and you may want to bring in more of your transactional lawyers, quite frankly, than your litigators. And that's it.
Very good.
The conference is now in talk mode.
Hey, George, this is Fred.
Yes, sir.
What just happened to my lien rights? I can't waive them in advance.
Well, yeah, but you still got a statute. But what are you gonna lien? You're getting paid in full.
Well, I'm gonna get my cost, but what about my share of the profit?
Well, if you didn't perform the goals, the profit's gone, and as you've got the waiver of all your rights. That's why I said that. You know, typically, if there's not a consensus, and what you're talking about, I guess, is a situation where one of the parties who feels they did, you know, that yes, I reached the goal. As I remember, be careful. Remember what I said. It doesn't have to be your fault. If the team doesn't make that budget goal, for instance, then all the team members' profit gets hit, and usually gets hit to the extent that they try to make up for the shortfall in the budget goal. So,
But since
I'm not sure what it is you'd be leaning for unless you felt that somehow the party's wrongfully determined. But if it's a consensus, then you were involved in that decision as to how much getting hit on everybody's profit. And if you disagreed and it went through the whole process and the consensus wasn't reached and the owner made the final decision, as I said, typically the contracts I've seen is a reservation of rights. And you can file your appeal. And if you want to file your claim, there's nothing that precludes you from filing your claim, though. You're going to, I think, have a uphill battle as to what it is you're claiming, given the waiver of rights relates to the claims against each other. But you're right, you can't have an advanced waiver of lien rights, but you only have lien rights to the extent you got a claim.
Right. What about the flow of money where you have a lender? Doesn't the lender almost have to be a party to this? Or is
no.
it still...
As I said, the lender adds a complication. Most lenders, given how they operate, and they operate, as we all know, within very fixed parameters of this is how I do a construction loan. And don't give me an animal that doesn't look like this, because if you do, it ain't getting, you're not getting your loan. So I think, it's, for instance, a project where it really was IPD was Disney. Well, Disney's self-funding this project. They're not going off and getting a construction loan on this. So I think, for the near term, these IPD contracts that you're going to see are going to be contracts like with a Disney or a Ford Motor Company or, a Princeton University or one of the big medical hospital groups, who essentially are not going off and getting a single construction loan, but are handling this funding in-house so they don't have to deal with those issues.
Well, just like with Design Build 20 years ago, we had to change the statutes to give recognition to what was being done in the field, and I suspect we're going to have the same type of evolution on this particular delivery system too over time.
Yep, no doubt.
Good job, George. Thank you.
Yeah, excellent job, George.
Good job. Somebody else say good job. Okay, everyone, thanks a lot, and we will see you the second Monday in December. Thanks.
Thanks.